I'm Mark Gagan, and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise-scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Today's guest is Miles Wooler, President and CEO of Ryan Specialty Underwriting Managers, the underwriting arm of Ryan Specialty. As such, Miles is responsible for more than 20 MGUs, offering more than 150 lines of business, and employing around 550 staff in 27 offices who wrote $2.4 billion of gross premium in 2021. This means he has a fantastic view of the market and where all its pressure points are to be found. A listen to this podcast will definitely get you right up to speed with all the cut and thrust of US and international specialist lines. But Miles is also a great business builder and manager, and in our chat we really get to the heart of the Ryan Specialty modus operandi. For instance, how does Miles keep an incredibly diverse business with multiple brands housing a huge variety of underwriting entrepreneurs within a core strategic Ryan Specialty identity and culture? Very few executives have to maintain and incentivize innovation and creativity on such a scale, while at the same time keeping on top of all of the compliance and reporting demands of a major unit of a fast-growing public company. Miles exudes a calm competence at every turn, and it's abundantly clear that he thinks really deeply about the industry. For instance, his thoughts on the effects of inflation on the sector, on cyber insurance, his business's relationship with technology, and the burgeoning hybrid carrier phenomenon are highly insightful, and that's just to mention four topics among many more. Suffice to say that I learnt an awful lot during this interview, and I think that you will too. Enjoy the podcast. This episode is supported by Oxbow Partners. Oxbow Partners is a management consulting business specializing in the London, Bermuda, and European insurance and reinsurance markets. In fact, in 2021 and 2022, they were named one of the top 10 consultancies in the sector by the Financial Times. It's fascinating speaking to the team about the kinds of topics they're supporting. Helping reinsurers take a strategic view of their operating models. Designing smart follow syndicates in the Lloyd's market. And developing ESG responses. The company's strapline talks about giving executives a fresh perspective. So if you're keen to understand the challenges and opportunities coming down the track for your business, I'd recommend giving the team at Oxbow Partners a call. Miles, welcome to the Voice of Insurance.
Great to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, Miles, it's probably a good idea to set the scene a little bit and give the listeners something of a tour of Ryan Specialty Underwriting Managers. And to give them a bit of a feel for the size and scale of the business, because this is a business that's grown a huge amount.
Absolutely. I'm happy to start there, Mark. So at its core, Ryan Specialty Underwriting Managers is comprised of 22 MGUs, plus our National Specialty Programs unit. That unit in and of itself has about 20 distinct offerings within it. Overall, we offer about 150 lines of coverage, and we underwrote $2.4 billion of premium last year. So when you look across our family, there's actually 22 offices in the U.S. There's additional five internationally. We have 550 teammates. About 375 of those are underwriters. That $2.4 billion is comprised of 67,000 policies in force and approximately 200 carrier agreements behind it to make that possible.
That's pretty interesting. It's a very, very broad business. That's going to give you a pretty broad view of the specialty market. So how is that market bearing up at the moment? Is this favorable rating environment holding up? Is there any signs of some of the pressures easing in different classes?
Yeah, so without a doubt, there is a fatigue in a few classes. We're in our third cycle now of pushing rate on most line. Generally speaking, I would say rate continues to compound. I'm quite pleased with the profitability we've been able to deliver to carrier partners over the last few years. But look, in fairness, they need more back, Mark. If you look back in 17, 18, 19, extremely soft period for casualty. Property rates have been accelerating. However, the number of named events have been as well. And I think many others see favorable tailwinds for years to come to get carriers back to the right level of profitability.
We've had these mid-year renewals. Is it property cat that's still really feeling the heat the most?
I'd say property cat and cyber. So property, I think we all saw that the June 1 reinsurance renewals were not fully met. I've heard rumors that July 1, there's expected to be an even greater gap. So I think we'll continue to see pretty substantial hardening there. Cyber is probably the other bucket there. We're in 12 or 18 months in, I'd say I call it a board level epiphany moment of the risks of cyber aggregation. The good news in my mind, though, Mark, is we're finally at a stage where the measurements and understanding of the risk is better, and therefore the remuneration for that risk is at least on the right path. There's more to come, but I think that there's a better understanding that's going to allow us to be compensated properly for it.
Presumably now, at least you can get the information that you really wanted, maybe at the bottom of the softer end of that cyber market. You couldn't get that information, presumably. That would just mean that you wouldn't get shown the business, or the business would be placed elsewhere to another market that wasn't asking for so much detail. Is it right then to assume that you're more comfortable as underwriters with ransomware, that it's become more of a known quantity than being this horrible wave that came out of not quite nowhere, but it just came in a big wave, didn't it?
There's been two major evolutions in the last few years. First is to make sure, and I'm proud we were early movers on this, to make sure that property or other coverage is not offering essentially free incidental coverage on cyber. So we've been at the forefront of making sure our policies, and I think the whole industry is caught up to that as well. And therefore, cyber is falling into the cyber realm and people are charging for it properly. The other big innovation really is the aggregation tracking. I think for many years, people talk about systemic exposure, but it's more than just aggregating your 10 biggest line sizes and estimating a loss there. That measurement has come a long way in my mind.
So we can thank a lot of the investment that's gone into the modeling, a lot of those companies, to they're starting to pay off some kind of return that you can start to have this more dynamic modeling of portfolios.
I completely agree. So properties have the benefit of RMS for almost 25 years now. AIR, also a few decades, I believe, at this stage. Cyber is quickly coming around the curve in those tools, which will help give us more comfort in talking to one another about the risk.
Because, of course, you know, a property is a property and it doesn't tend to move around unless it's on wheels, and then it ceases to be property from an underwriter's perspective. But then, of course, but cyber is so fluid, isn't it? All our risk changes every time we upgrade our software or change software.
Well, I think we're in the middle of a big test here in the Ukraine-Russia war, certainly. All eyes are on our known activist state plotting against that region. So everybody's in kind of a heightened defensive posture now. So I think we're going to know an outcome here soon.
And going back to what you said about property cat, given that there has been shortfalls in capacity, presumably that is really helping you see so much more business. I presume that does mean that flows are coming in your direction.
Since capacity's down, the byproduct is average stretches are shorter, and therefore producers need to find more outlets to lay off that exposure. And then additionally, the structuring is up. There's a lot more pricing, doing a product X wind or the wind only component to break it down to its component parts just to fill the gaps in the marketplace.
And given that there is, let's say, not a total shortage of capacity, but that there is more discerning capacity at the highest end of the market, can you get the capacity yourselves as a group? You can access that capacity. Presumably, if you can't access that capacity, then probably no one can.
Well, we've been fortunate. Our renewals, we have several MGUs that have cat-type exposure. Those renewals are deliberately placed around the year, so we're not caught on one date. And so we have been successful and look to take as much advantage of this opportunity as we can.
It's amazing how many lines you're already in, and through how many different distinct entities you've got to do that in different brands. Having been around for 12 years, have you constructed the full portfolio of MGAs?
People have often joked, do we get extra credit for launching new MGUs or naming new MGUs? And the reality is we'll have as many MGUs as there are unique opportunities, but we're not aspiring just to build MGUs. We have three MGUs in the works where they're actually adding kind of tangential products or incremental capacity to their core facilities. We have one we've talked about publicly, so I'll mention it. We have Emerald is going to be our first pure play excess casualty facility with offices in both London and Chicago. So we're building where it's logical. The portfolio is never going to be complete in the foreseeable future. There's a few products we'll probably avoid, but we're always looking to provide new solutions.
The world is always changing so fast anyway that you could never say we've got all the MGUs we'd ever need.
Yeah, and I guess I'd say our logic in building these, Mark, is none of this is really based on where we are in the cycle, right? We're building something that's going to weather decades and all sorts of cycles. So we're not just looking for opportunities. We don't want to compete in Main Street. We're looking to distinguish ourselves through solution or service or unique people in the industry.
Another phenomenon that's happening, obviously, we haven't just got the market. We've got to live in the world and the economy that we are being served. This year, inflation has been news all around the world, all major economies, for various reasons. How clear and present are you seeing those inflationary pressures in the US market? And how's that affecting the way you underwrite?
So it's here and it's real. And we talk about it substantially internally. And I think as an industry, we need to talk about it further. It's become most apparent in a few property reserves. I've seen actually one or two items that were 3 years old. The reserves move. Reserves are set prudently by a TPA. And then inflation has not been applied to the loss over the last 3 years. And it did result in getting on folks' radar. Those are two examples I've seen, which means there's probably thousands or tens of thousands of others in the industry that we need to be thinking about. So I think what we're seeing in pushing down into our units are two factors. Number one, we are being very forward with producers about ensuring that TIVs and statement of values are correct on buildings. We're doing the carriers and the insureds a disservice if those aren't accurate. We're even marking up SOVs if we think they're off market. That might cost us a little business, but we're willing to take those steps. There's not going to be any advantage to those being understated.
Because it's going to save you a lot of problems in the long run. Because I presume somebody comes in with a property risk that's got very static values. It's been static over the last 4 or 5 years or 10 years. And presumably you must know that if you can't have 10% inflation or 9% inflation or whatever it is, and there not be some change in those values to reflect that.
That's the exact example I give, Mark. It's human nature that the TIV wasn't refreshed from a year or two ago, but at this stage, we all know that key building inputs are compounding at 10% a year, and we have to take that action. And I'm proud to say RMG are taking that action.
That's good. And I suppose it's to make sure everyone's got the right limits as well. And what about on the casualty side? Is anything seeping through into award levels yet?
Well, I think our industry is a bit more disciplined. Social inflation became a more common theme 2 to 3 years ago. Overall, casualty as a marketplace and sector was punished in late 18 and 19 in the soft cycle. So I would say pricing terms and conditions have dramatically increased. And then reserving actuaries have become pretty adept at factoring in the inflationary factors of casualty.
Is that because casualty has always had its eye on any inflationary or social inflationary pressures? So is it just because of the nature of the beast? So they're always looking harder anyway, so they'll always adjust quicker.
When I think of property versus casualties, so property ultimately has a measurable replacement cost. Casualty rarely does ultimately. I mean, so it's more what's the limit in place? And even I think we're all aware that there's juries that are awarding through those limits even. So I think the prudence in that is much greater understood today than it was 3 to 5 years ago.
Talking more widely about the MGA, MGU space within the Anglo-Saxon world, on both sides of the Atlantic and anywhere within the old kind of UK Commonwealth world, you see MGAs, MGUs as being a regular and now totally trusted part of the insurance value chain and has been for a very long time. It's not necessarily always the case in those non-Anglo-Saxon based markets. Do you think other markets will be receptive to this phenomenon over time?
Yeah, so I do spend a substantial amount of time thinking about our non-US footprint. We have 5 MGUs operating internationally. 3 of them are truly global in nature. We are hiring, I know you're thinking broader field, but I will just touch on what we're doing in the UK and Europe. So we've made a commitment to material increase in investment in our international renewable energy space. We have 3 senior underwriting execs joining as soon as their garden is over. Our excess casualty team is headquartered in both London and Chicago. And our international rep and warranty, or WI team, has doubled in staff in continental Europe within the last year. And we've actually opened an office in Madrid, starting from our original footprint in Barcelona. Right now, we don't have brick and mortar further into Eastern Europe, but we are driving it out of Spain. We've studied continental Europe substantially. Others have as well. Solutions are a little harder to come by there because the global insurers are well entrenched. The Swiss, the Zurich, the Generali, Allianz are all used to dealing with captive distribution force. So the MGU model is a little bit less evolved there. We do continue to research it and look for opportunities. I think beyond that, we're studying Asia and Australia as the logical next stepping stones.
And in terms of when you're going about creating a new unit, a new MGU, MGA, do you have a particular way of going about this? Do you have a methodology, have a check sheet that you like to be able to check off before you make that investment or take that plunge into a new segment of the market?
Well, I think it's important that we define what we're going to solve for and how we're going to do it better than other current solution providers. Ideally, if we can bring something truly new by looking 5, 10, 15 years forward, that's a great outcome as well. I'm pleased to say Concord Specialty is a U.S. rep and warranty company. We acquired it approximately 10 years ago as an innovator in the space. And so a unit like that is always looking ahead into tax solutions, specific and contingent lit solutions. So sometimes those can be just as meaningful to us to build those tangent products and bring new staff in to solve for them.
Is it sometimes just about finding the right people? Do you see a specialist MGA that's already doing something? Obviously, there is acquisition as well. Is it sometimes just finding a great team and thinking, wow, we just want them to join us?
100%. So a big part of our thesis, Mark, we always use the terminology that every one of our MGUs and programs is led by a top decile underwriting talent. So these are people that have traditionally come from decades in the carrier side or decades building and leading MGUs. Every time it starts with someone that's a master of their trade, whether it's one person or a larger team. And then Ryan Specialty surrounds that in Fortune 1000 resources ranging from legal, regulatory, compliance, technology, actuarial, cap modeling, carrier relationships, producer relationships. Ideally, the individual head underwriter is also a business leader and business builder. But to the extent they don't have the entire acumen behind them, we can surround them with those resources so that the focus always remains on the underwriting and product.
You've got 20 units, hundreds of lines of business. Is there a unifying cultural element to all of them, or do you allow them all to be sort of mavericks in their own way? And obviously, you've got the central services for them, you know, their compliance, the finance, HR, and that kind of stuff. And do you just let them go? Or do you want to create something that has a unifying part to it?
I love that question, Mark. And I've been spending more and more time thinking about it in the last 6 to 12 months. But not only being public, but in the world of COVID, as the world is fully reopened and we're making sure everybody's in the office or on the road. So I think a lot more about this than I used to. So broadly speaking, we do try to push down our core principles and keep those uniform in every MGU: entrepreneurial spirit, client centricity, integrity, meritocracy, because it is important that our carriers know that they are dealing with a Ryan Specialty entity as a backstop behind that product and team. But we were quite deliberate 12 years ago keeping the names of each MGU. It allows them recognition in the marketplace, lets the producer understand they're given expertise often. And then it allows the president or CEO of the unit to really further define their own trademark culture. And I use the word pride of place, right? It's important for people to have an affinity to what they do, know that they can leave their mark on it. And I think that's a big factor of attraction for our entities.
So you're trying to get the best of both worlds. You know, they've got the credibility of knowing it's a Ryan Specialty company and that everything's going to be fulfilled in the way that everyone would expect it to be. But at the same time, you give them that individuality.
Exactly the case.
But it's interesting what you said about since the pandemic, you thinking more about culture. Do you think it was the pandemic that made it more important? Because of course, we're all sitting at home, isolated. And did it make it seem more valuable to have something that was unifying, that would say, this is a Ryan Specialty company and I'm working for Ryan Specialty, that it made it seem more important to have that identity? Because, of course, you could lose that identity if everyone's sitting in their living rooms.
I should mention our offices are open. At the present, it's essentially a hybrid model.
Yeah.
But behind that, though, Mark, it's not enough just to open the doors and cater in pizza and say you can catch up with your friends, right? We want it to be a factor that is attracting people, that culture, right? There's studies where people want to work in environments where they have a friend, where they know they can collaborate, where it's a culture they enjoy, where they can learn and have access to other leaders in the industry. We're past the stage now where, you know, look, the offices are open, and now we want to make sure that it's a beacon where people want to be here. They want to collaborate. They want to learn. They want to understand what's next for them.
When I look at your financial statements, and of course, now I can read them every quarter if I want to, and all that detail that now being a public company has made you disclose, we look at the financial statements, we see Ryan Specialty Underwriting Managers separated from the binder business. Can you just sort of explain roughly what that demarcation is? Because the binder part of the company doesn't report to you.
That's correct. So we've chosen this to report them separately. And I guess the biggest distinction, Mark, and I don't think this would surprise you, is MGUs and programs, they're going to be typically larger limit, more bespoke underwriting.
Yeah.
Whereas the binding side of the business is going to be more carrier defined. And if it doesn't fit, it's going to go into referral or kick out faster. And as such, because the box is more defined, the binding resides within the RT side of the house within the direct production sites. But when you step past that, and I think this is a clear trend, we're probably one of the folks that don't aggregate this on report to the market, but Ryan especially does want to be responsive to the overall trends of delegated underwriting authority in the marketplace. And so when I think of the total services we're providing on behalf of the carrier, it's more likely to be in the excess of $5 billion marker when you add together all of the MGUs, programs, and binding across Ryan Specialty. And I think that's important because, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, those centralized services exist across all of these towers, the actuarial, the cap modeling, the technology, the governance. Those are some of the most important tools that we can bring to the carrier.
You've just said it there. You are a very substantial MGU player in any market, and particularly in the US market. What's been really interesting in the last couple of years, obviously, we know that MGAs, MGUs have been growing, and obviously within the E&S market, which of course has also been outgrowing the admitted market. Within that, we've had this trend of this hybrid fronting carrier model, and I wouldn't say that that is your model at all. But given that you're so close to what's going on in that space, what do you think's behind that? It seems very interesting. Is it a secular change or is it something that is cyclical and may come and go?
So on the hybrid front, it is a surprise how fast it's grown within the last several years. So certainly State National was one of the last entities standing. Clear Blue was launched about 7 years ago. And now within the last three, there's been 30 plus. We do have a few programs using those hybrid models. I do expect more will launch. I guess I would say, though, maybe at the heart of your question, the segment and trend hasn't played out exactly how I had guessed when the momentum was picking up. I had anticipated that these hybrids would be more transformers of non-traditional capital than they have become. I think to date, they appear to be supported by traditional reinsurance markets bringing startups into the marketplace, which is great. I think the focus and opportunity set for delegated authority startups is great. But I think the next evolution is going to be bringing non-traditional capital into our segment.
Yes, I had someone on podcast a while back espousing that theory about the reinsurers being the main backers, partly over a very long period of time. They've lost some of that connection because, of course, as their traditional cedents have got bigger and bigger and bigger, and become the top 10 global insurers in the world, their reinsurance relationship with those big insurance carriers has changed, and therefore they don't get the same amount of more proportional and some of the lower premium, lower limit business that they used to get. And now their relationship is very much more sort of taking away the extreme volatility and tail risk than it was. And therefore that appetite is there to get closer to risk, which is obviously what you can do with an MGA, MGU structure, and that might be behind it. But it's interesting to say about alternative. Is there any evidence that some of the alternative capital is going to come and play? And are you seeing any of that? You're not seeing it at the moment, but you're seeing perhaps more than there ever was.
Well, I think part of it is the world is accustomed to cap property ILS funds. So the short duration obviously allows that to work. There's been a bit of a pause button, though, because I think in the last 5 years, four haven't materialized, and therefore there's a lot of money stuck in collateral. The runoff market is quite efficient nowadays. But as an investor, you have to get comfortable that that market will be there in 3 years or 5 years, whenever you want to roll out of this asset into the next asset. There's the belief that the market's there and that it's at a price that you're willing to tolerate. One of the most powerful parts about the Lloyd's of London model, actually, I mean, certainly it's licensing, certainly it's centralized fund, but in my mind, it's actually the three-year reinsurance to close cycle. That is a powerful tool that at the 30th anniversary, the book is assessed, the price is agreed, and there's a means to arbitrate and move on if it doesn't fit. The U.S. is a little bit tough. It is very hard to novate risk in the U.S., but I think we'll be closer to solutions. And I'm sure we're going to see them within 2 to 4 years, if I were to take a guess.
That would be a key to some of these guys being able to get liquid again and move on to the next risk and not having their collateral stuck for too long.
Exactly. So I think for a pension or a sovereign or a family office to park X dollars, they love the asset class, they love the economics, but it's that uncertainty of, do I want to commit to this 5-year tail, 8-year tail? But as soon as there's a means to value it at a midpoint and provide liquidity, I should say in an efficient manner, I mean, the means exist today.
Yeah.
It's more making them efficient and marketable.
It's a trend we all need to watch. Something else, a massive trend that of the last 5, 6, 7 years, obviously it's been with us all the time, it's technology. And you mentioned technology as being perhaps one of those central offerings that you can bring to all the different faces of your business. How have you engaged with this whole burgeoning insurtech scene of the last 5, 6 years? And what sort of tools have you found that it's produced that you found most useful in your own business?
We've had our own foray into outward-facing rating tools. I would say we've met it with limited success. And now part of that, Mark, is we don't want to just risk being a price, right? Some of these products have become a little bit of a race to, hey, I can get you a quote on 15 questions, and so the neighbor can get you a quote on 5 questions. That's really not where the MGUs tend to play. We do want to be efficient, but not when it exposes to price and lack of underwriting data. So when I think of the insurtech space, fintech, where we have had the most engagement, it's really been with like the data acquisition vendors. So we have our own on and offshore developers. We're comfortable generating our own rating tools, our own internal and externally facing portals. But the value that I've seen is coming from the data providers.
What about some of those ones that are purporting to help triage your underwriter's inbox, for example, to say, hey, I'm going to rank these and say you should look at this one first because this is really with an appetite and you probably get a firm order on it and it's very profitable. Then that one second, and then right at the bottom, you have to have a rummage around yourself because I'm not sure if they're a bit marginal. What about those kinds of tools? Have you had a look at any of those?
The ones we're using the most of, Mark, that I'm the most impressed with, and I'm going to skip names here, but there's a few vendors out there that are doing a pretty prolific job ingesting statements of values. You know, I guess they're bouncing it out 1,000 different available data sets, and they're bringing it back into a standardized format. And so I think that is a great trend. When it comes to declination engines, prioritization engines, we've chose to do a lot of that work ourselves because, number one, no one knows our appetite better than us. And then we're also able to feed back characteristics of our interactions with those brokers and the loss ratios with those specific classes of business. So at the moment, we're doing a lot of that prioritization and declination work ourselves.
Is there any back office stuff that you found useful? As we see everyone's expense ratio is permanently under pressure. Anything you found that really has brought success in bringing things down? Obviously, what we've been talking about so far is about how to do things better, how to underwrite better, how to ingest data better, make better decisions. Any of the back office stuff, let's say the less exciting end of things, that's been really useful?
The operating backbone has certainly been part of Ryan's specialty underwriting manager's competitive advantage, right? So good workflow and data management is really table stakes for the industry right now. So the years of doing any double entry is way behind us. And so when I think of our structure and advantage, all of our MGUs operate on the same operating platform. We have common policy issuance system, and then we have the shared resources around that are also shared. Policy admin, IT, finance, that the people you would expect. So that's the table stakes again. The breakthrough moments are in the individual rating tools of the business, right? And so I often use the word tech-enabled rather than insurtech, and maybe I should say insurtech and give us a higher multiple, but tech-enabled, I mean we bring all the data and analytics into the front of the underwriter to make the best use of their time. So a UA will set up the rater, they'll load the submission data, they'll load the claims data, they'll make all the claims, all the data calls through APIs, name, rank, and serial number, location, elevation, crime score, et cetera, up to our proprietary analytics. And then the goal then is our underwriters have everything in front of them and we're making the best use of their time when they're in front of the file.
UA, underwriting assistant.
Yes.
Always on a war against abbreviations.
Yeah, thank you.
But we were talking about stock multiples earlier on, and Ryan Specialty obviously had its IPOs, now publicly quoted stock. How has that changed any aspects of the way you go about things?
Well, we've always had a high bar and ambitious goals because the market's certainly expecting that. There is more emphasis on quarterly results, whereas that's probably the biggest change in being public. But in fairness, Mark, we're going to be good stewards of capital regardless of the quarter and the year. So the biggest change, therefore, has come down to improving communication and on forecasting trends. But that's tricky, right? Because everybody wants to know about next quarter and the quarter after. So it's an art of gradually kind of updating where we're going.
These days, it sounds like with the sort of technology that you have embedded, you could do results every day if you wanted to, but obviously you wouldn't leave much time for actual day job.
Well, we do publish our revenue every night at midnight.
Wow.
It's a good trademark of our business to get ahead of trends in the business, right? So competitive pressure is always good for businesses, but frankly, Mark, I'm always looking for outliers, right? Where there's only so much time in the day. I want to look for if there's successes, how do we continue to compound that success? If someone's faltering, if I can kind of peel back some layers and see how to best help that situation. Before we move on, I do want to say that going public, a meaningful element of that has been our stock as a currency in the marketplace, essentially, right? So that's given employees a lot to rally behind. I believe it's helped us with both retention and recruiting of team members.
Well, absolutely. It's done very well. So I'm sure it can't do any harm, Miles. I just wanted to say, before we finish up, I just wanted to thank you for your time. I've come to the end of all my questions, unless you have anything to add. Because things are moving so fast, Miles, make sure that we'll book in some time to come and talk to us again and update us in a year's time or less than that, I hope, because things are moving so fast and things are really exciting. So good luck with everything and good luck with the continued growth and come and speak to us soon.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity here today, Mark. I look forward to staying in touch. We're an exciting time in delegated authority and I look forward to speaking again soon. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this program. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry. The Voice of Insurance podcast is produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling enterprise scale underwriting through a single pane of glass. Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.